Hey guys, before we get started, this podcast has some strong language. You've been warned.
Hi, this week's episode of The Rabble was recorded at 12:04 p.m. on Wednesday, November 6, 2019, in the great state of Texas, where the official state shrub is Texas sage.
This is The Rabble, a podcast by Rouser. We are three progressive Texans who felt like flipping some tables after the 2016 election. But we decided a more productive use of our energy would be to flip congressional seats instead. So for the last couple of years, we've been learning to become activists, eventually quitting our corporate jobs to form our new venture, Rouser. Our goal is to inspire other progressive Texans to get some shit done and to share the stories of the candidates, electeds, and organizers who inspire us to do shit. Welcome to the unruly mob.
Every week, we will have three distinct segments. First up is always political fuck, marry, kill. Now, as you guys know, we are not fucking, marrying, or killing politicians, but political stuff that's going on this week. So, for example, this week I want to fuck, marry, and kill the overwhelmingly positive but kind of mixed bag of the elections from last night.
And next up, we'll have Becky's Did Y'all Know segment, this week with candidate for U.S. Senate Amanda Edwards.
And Ashley will close us out with our shit to do for this week.
We're your hosts. I'm Kristen Gunn.
I'm Becky Bullard.
I'm Ashley Chang. Together, we're Rouser, and this is The Rabble.
All right, and we're back. So before we get started, I am so jazzed. We've been putting a ton of work into this live show on November 19th. It's going to be our last episode of the first season of The Rabble, and it's going to be a huge party at the Riveter.
I'm so excited.
And y'all, we have a beer sponsor, so there will be beer. It's confirmed.
Yay!
From Circle Brewing Co. I'm so excited about them. They are hugely supportive of progressive causes. Back in the during the Beto U.S. Senate run, they had a Beto beer that they did.
Oh, so that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
So, it was really good, too.
I know. So we've got good beer and good progressive beer.
Oh, my God. Life goals are getting big enough to where they make a beer for us.
Okay, the Rabble beer?
The Rabble beer.
This could be our in.
All right.
So join us at November 19th. What else will be going on there is?
Oh my gosh, I am really excited because we are going to be giving our audience members tools on how to have conversations about difficult topics at Thanksgiving and the holidays. I think it's going to be really enlightening and probably pretty funny.
Yeah, and we're doing this because we all really need this ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, are the tools like which way you should flip the table to make sure that the gravy doesn't get on you? Because that's what I need right now. No?
That's pretty funny.
Is that not what we're doing?
No, we're going to be talking about stuff like, you know, how to be a good ally to people of color in rooms full of just white people rather than keeping your mouth shut and when people say really racist and terrible things, which is the path I've taken a lot. The path that I'm trying to learn how to do better. So that's one of the things that we'll be talking about.
I think, you know, we need to find the middle ground between me, who is the continual table flipper and hole puncher inner, and, and you know, the quietly saying nothing. So I'm excited for this.
Yeah.
Plus, it's just going to be a really fun party, right?
Totally. Yeah. We've got really great guests that are coming. Deanna Lermon Mercado, the chair of the Travis County Democratic Party.
House Rep. Jeannie Hinojosa.
Oh, my gosh. Total Shiro. Royce Brooks, executive director of Annie's List. And, of course, Emily Ramshaw, editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune. And you know we're, like, basically a Texas Trib fan pod.
So get your tickets. You can find us on social at RouserTX. There will be a link in the show notes. Come hang out with us. Come party. Have some Circle Brew beer. Because it'll be our last chance to hang before the end of our season.
Yeah.
And if you wait too long, ticket prices will go up.
Oh, that's true. It's early bird prices right now, but that... I forget the day that it goes up, but
I mean tomorrow. Whatever day you're listening to this, tomorrow is the day the prices go up. So you need to do it today.
Do it.
The All end. Right. All right, ladies. So I have the fuck this week. I'm really excited. I've wanted to talk about this for a couple of weeks now. So we had Winnie Davis back on the pod in April. And in hearing the extended director's cut of her story on how she came to politics, one of the things that I learned during that interview was politics and getting involved was just as intimidating for her as it is for me when she got started. A group of people that she met up with and that took her to a city council meeting and helped her testify for the first time and, you know, showed you where the water fountain is and where the bathrooms are and where to park and what to say and, you know, the right type of shoes to wear and all of those things.
Pink tennis shoes?
You know what? One can hope it's just been a consistent, like the cartoon character of her life is that, you know, she opens the closet and it's just a bunch of pink tennis shoes. So, you know, in hearing that, I was like, that's amazing because now she's like a superhero, right? You know, I think, you know, a lot of us look at her and just see this person that always was this regal, magnificent wealth of knowledge. But knowing she was just as normal as I am was something that was really exciting. And so the thing that I've just been bubbling over to talk about is there is an organization here in Austin that's called A Functional Democracy, and their mission is literally to do just what Wendy had at the beginning of her political career, which was to bring people into city council meetings to educate them on how to get involved with the process, to really demystify it and make it fun, and to empower them to give testimony for the first time. So there is an event on December 11th that I am a fellow for, and what that means, that's just a fancy way of saying I volunteered to learn more and to have them help me, and then I'm going to help other people during this event.
Wait, so, are you the next Wendy Davis?
I mean, this is like a backdoor way of me saying no.
You are the next Wendy Davis, or maybe you would be holding the hand of the next Wendy Davis.
So if you... If you, dear listener, think there are rumblings in your soul that you might want to become the next Wendy Davis, I want to help you. Seriously, I say this tongue in cheek. I want to find as many folks that listen to this podcast as possible that are interested in potentially coming with me on December 11th in the evening. It's going to be super fun. There's going to be drinks and food and, you know, all sorts of educational moments. But also, it's just going to be kind of a party, too.
It's called We the Party.
Yeah, it's called We the Party. And it's super genius. But ultimately, I want to have my people there, which are you. You people that listen to this podcast are my people. Come with me and see me mock testify for the first time. And if you're into doing that, you can do it along with me. And so
that's the thing, right? It's not even a real city council meeting. Yeah. It's a practice.
Yes,
so you don't even have to be even a little bit scared because it's all just practice.
Yeah. And so it's literally the whole We the Party event is at City Hall. A Functional Democracy has secured City Hall for the evening. And there'll be a lot of fun stuff going on. But a lot of the city council members, including my city council member, Jimmy Flanagan, are going to be there, and Mayor Adler as well. And they will be sitting in their normal seats. And, you know, it'll be kind of like a mock trial of sorts, but not trial. It's, you know, a mock city council meeting. Mock trial is like if you ever did that in high school. OK, but it's a mock city council meeting, and you get up there for 1 minute and you can talk about whatever you want. And if you want to talk about your dog, great. If you want to talk about something that is involved with the city that you really care about and are passionate about, that's great, too. And A Functional Democracy has a couple of different ways for you to prep for this event, from watching online videos to you can text the word local GOV to 474747, and they will send you prompts that kind of step you through the process.
That's cool.
Or you can literally, you can take a page out of the Kristen Gunn playbook and you can just show up. And that's what I do all the time.
Really, we're all just kind of winging it, even if we do
fake it till you make it. Fake it till you make it. I'm a big fan of that. So,
oh my God, I just texted. It's super cute. Y'all should all do it. 474747 local gov and see the adorable photo that pops up. Also, I've been to a functional democracy, and I've been to one of their events, and it was so awesome. It was such a fun party. They had comedians, they had
art installations. It was just a really creative approach to helping people understand the importance of local government, and I so appreciated it.
And if you enjoy our vibe and how we try to bring like whimsy and like a lightheartedness to a civic engagement, I think you'll really love their organization if you don't follow them already. They have a zine that helped me figure out like what the process is with city council and, you know, who the major players are, and so definitely worth looking
also
into
if
them.
You're listening in another city, you could start something like this in your city and help other people understand how local government works. And we can put you in touch with the people who run A Functional Democracy, and they can tell you all their tips and tricks for how they've done it. Because I believe that this needs to exist everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Or if you live in a different city and maybe you're not that far along in your path, reach out to us and we will help connect you with a group that's already doing something similar. To end the fuck that I've been wanting to fuck for several weeks now, really, this is not an empty extension of an invitation. It would make my internal goal is 10 people. So I'm hoping to get at least 10 people to join me on December 11th to do this, whether you're watching me testify or testifying yourself. If you're interested in coming and partying with me, private message me on Facebook or Instagram. You know how to find me, Kristen Gunn, or you can message Rouser at RouserTX on any of the socials. But I want you there with me.
Yay.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
Okay, Becky, what are you marrying this week?
Okay, I want to marry this newly formed bipartisan Texas House Criminal Justice Reform Caucus.
That is a mouthful.
It sure is.
You're going to have to explain this to me.
Okay, so it's a group of legislators in our Texas legislature that is pretty evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. And they have come together to ask Governor Abbott and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles for more time to review new findings in the case of Rodney Reed, who is sentenced to death. So backstory here.
Yeah, I thank you for that, because I was about to say I've heard the name. It seems like something that's buzzing around the water cooler right now, but I don't really know that much about it.
I know that Kim Kardashian and Rihanna are on board and working on this.
Yes.
And that's the only headline I know.
Right. So, you know, Kim Kardashian has used her celebrity lately to bring to light cases, death penalty cases, where there's some question about whether that person is actually guilty or not. And that's the case with Rodney Reed. So in 1996, 19-year-old Stacy Stites, a woman in Bastrop, was raped and murdered on her way to work. And Rodney Reed has been sentenced to death for her murder because about a year after that murder, sperm cells from Stites' body were identified as belonging to Reed. Now, he all along has said that the two of them had a casual, consensual relationship, and that's since been corroborated by people who knew either one of them. However, at the time, Stites was engaged to a man named Jimmy Fennell. So when her body was found, there was what they think is a murder weapon, her belt. There were pieces of it found where her body was found, and then also nearby Fennell's truck, her fiancé's truck, was abandoned, and pieces of her belt was found there too. Fennell was a local police officer, and he was initially a suspect, but he eventually, because of the sperm cells that were found belonging to Reed, the prosecutors decided that he was the guilty one, and so he ended up in prison and now sentenced to death. But in the time between then and now, they never examined the murder weapon. They didn't do a lot of forensic evidence until more recently. And basically, the Fennell's attorneys, their argument was that because Reed was a black man and Stites was a white woman, and there weren't interracial relationships that were consensual in 1996 in Bastrop, like, this couldn't have been what he's claiming.
That was going to be my question.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't seen any of the images. I was going to say, wild guess.
Yeah.
Is Rodney Reed a black man? And is Fennell this
a
third
white
guy?
Police
he's
officer.
A white police officer. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, wait. He's a police officer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so another police officer said she heard Fennell say that he would strangle Stites with a belt if he ever found out she cheated on him. Also, Fennell, he had been found to be deceptive on two polygraph tests when questioned about Stites' death.
So there's a lot that has called into question this case. And so this bipartisan group of Texas legislators came together this week and sent a letter to Governor Abbott. Here's an excerpt from their letter. "We appreciate how difficult decisions like this are and know how seriously you take them. But this is also an opportunity for you to prevent a rush to execution before these new leads are properly explored. Killing Rodney Reed without certainty about his guilt may erode public trust, not only in capital punishment, but in Texas justice itself." And I think that's really cool that it's not just Democrats. And this has been the case kind of on a national level. It seems that criminal justice, miraculously, and for reasons I don't totally understand, has become the issue that is the most bipartisan issue that I can think of at the moment.
Is it because of Kim Kardashian?
You know, I think
calling
that,
in to Trump's office.
But I also think, who is it in Trump's family?
Jared Kushner.
Right, right, right. So Jared Kushner's dad?
Kushner's dad is a convicted felon.
Right. Yeah. And so he, because of the experience of family members, has been pushing for criminal justice reform, and just further testament to your lived experience totally influences the causes that you're willing to champion. Mm-hmm. And because somebody that high up in government has family experience with a criminal justice system, it made it a priority for them. So,
and they might all be convicted felons really soon.
Yeah. Well, and there's, I mean, it's such a good point of the precedent setting. Obviously, we don't want to kill someone. Well, I just don't want to kill someone
no,
at all.
No, same.
But we certainly don't want to kill someone who's not guilty of something. And what message is that sending to humans?
People that are okay with killing people, like, punitively, would not want to kill someone who is innocent.
Exactly.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting to see what Governor Abbott does. I happen to know, I followed a case very closely in the last couple of years. The only death sentence that he has commuted in his time as governor was for a guy I went to high school with.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And white rich guy. So who definitely did it. He didn't pardon him. He just commuted the death penalty, part of his sentence. So he'll spend life in prison. My classmate who was on death row tried to kill his entire family for the insurance money, and also faked being hurt himself so that that would throw the suspicion off of him. But he was caught. And his father survived, but his brother and his mother did not. His father, who's, you know, a very rich white man, but, you know, a very big evangelical Christian, sought audience with Greg Abbott. And because of that, Greg Abbott I don't know the exact terminology, but commuted the sentence isn't right because he's still in jail. Like, he will spend the rest of his life in jail.
Resends him.
Yeah. He just commuted the death penalty portion of his sentence. Yeah. So it's really interesting. You know, my classmate did it. And so it'll be really interesting with Rodney Reed, because his guilt is absolutely in question.
Yeah.
I really hope that means something.
Well, if you would like to join Kim Kardashian and our Texas state legislators who are calling Governor Abbott and asking them to reconsider the evidence in this case and hold off on any sort of death penalty until the facts are laid bare, you can call Governor Abbott's office, 512-463-2000, and just ask for Rodney Reed's death sentence to be put on hold and the case to be reopened so that we can achieve true justice here. And that's it for my Mary.
All right. I love when things are bipartisan in good ways. It's a little, you know, my heart's growing a little bit like the Grinch.
Yeah, there's hope.
Yeah. All right, Ash, bring us down. Bring my heart down a couple sizes.
Okay, so I got the kill this week. And for my kill, I think school closures in Austin are my kill. And there's a question mark at the end of that because I don't know a ton about this topic. And as we just learned from our Mary, that, you know, you shouldn't kill something or someone.
unless you're totally sure.
Yeah, unless you got all the facts, right? So what I do know is that the school closures have been a huge hot button issue in Austin recently over the past months, year. You know, they've been talking about this for a long time. And there's a list of 12 schools, but right now they're only focusing on four, and there's plans to potentially move forward on the remaining eight starting next year. So they've decided that they want more community input on those. But the Austin Independent School District staff and board, they just met, and they had a meeting that was like almost 6 hours long the other night, this past Monday night.
People are really, really fired up about this, which I totally understand, because if it was my kid's school that was about to be closed, I would fight like hell to keep it open.
Exactly. And for a lot of these schools, I do know that, you know, they're like the anchors in these communities. And so when you're losing that, or you think about, like, so many people buy their houses or rent houses or move to a neighborhood because of the school.
We did, for sure.
Yeah.
What, so can you give me just like the cliff notes of like why a school closes and like what happens to the kids? I mean, like, even like three sentences, because that just, those are two big question marks for me.
Well, so I talked, because I don't know anything about this and I don't have kids, but that's like, that is one of my like triggers that I recently realized, is that when I hear people say, like, as a parent, I care about this, one, because of fertility problems I've had over the past year, but two, because it reminds me of when all those old white dudes during, like, Me Too movement or the Kavanaugh hearings.
Oh, because of my daughter.
Yeah. I have a mother, so I don't believe in sexual assault.
As though you shouldn't,
you know,
care.
But, like, for anyone out there who doesn't have kids, like, we should care about this because it is affecting our community. And one of the things that I want to talk about, too, is that it's affecting – I mean, there's a huge – like, equity conversation that needs to be had around these school closures. And because I didn't know anything about it, I called a friend of the pod, Arthi Singh, who is on the AISD Board of Trustees. And she was talking about how she's what feels a little bit alone in this conversation, because she's really hesitant about these remaining four potential school closures that they're voting on November 18th. And to answer your question, Kristen, she's hesitant about it because some of the schools don't have full plans put forth yet. So, you know, if they vote that they're definitely going to close these four schools on November 18th, some of the parents still won't know what's going to be happening to their kids next year.
Oh.
Right? So that feels – so her argument sounds like it's like, well, we just need to postpone this at the very least until December so that there can be, you know, a better thought out plan for it.
But, and schools close because of low performance?
It's a mix of low enrollment. But, okay, so I don't want to be the one answering these questions because I don't know what I'm talking about. And one of the things that Kristen has brought to our show recently was the idea of, wouldn't it be great when people ask you questions that you're like, oh, should I just BS this? Wouldn't it be nice if I could just pull, like, an expert out of my pocket? And we call that a political poly pocket. And so because I have two little pockets in my pants today, I'm going to pull out two experts. Okay, so I have these two experts that I just pulled out of my pocket here. Annika Olson, the Assistant Director of Policy Research, and Ricky Lowe, the Research Associate for the Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks, y'all, so much for jumping out of my pocket here. Help me out.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so let's get right into this. What is the biggest takeaway from your research on the potential impact of these school closures we're talking about?
Yeah, well, first off, we really want to mention that any scenario around school change really has to be focused on the child. AISD and all the school changes, we talk a lot about fiscal issues and infrastructure, but really any scenario regarding school change has to be centered on the child, especially their mental health and well-being. School closures and consolidations, we know, have a tremendous impact on children and cause a disruption to the community and can really eliminate a center of stability for children. So we need to think about these unintended consequences moving forward.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. I'd mentioned that I had talked to Arthi Singh, you know, on the school board, and that was one of the things she was saying that I really appreciated, the importance of, you know, when looking at things from an equitable lens, of actually making sure the community voices, the children and their parents, you know, included that. So I appreciate you saying that. I think that's a great perspective.
Well, and another thing also is that we do want to focus on vulnerable populations and what this means to the community. So a lot of the things that we've been looking at is how these school closures and consolidations would specifically impact the Black population. Because if you look at the data in 1991, Black population within the student body of AISD was about 20%. Now that has decreased by 56%, and so we're talking about less than 6,000 Black students, and that's going to continue to decline as far as AISD is concerned. So the fact that majority of the Black student population is concentrated on the east side, and that the original proposal had 9 schools closing on the East Side is going to definitely impact an already vulnerable population. So those are some of the things that we want to make sure that AISD recognizes.
Okay, well, thank you for that background.
Do we know why the student African-American student population is shrinking so
much? Right, so, good question. So essentially there was a research study conducted by one of our faculty fellows by the name of Dr. Eric Tang. And what he found was gentrification and displacement had a lot to do with black communities leaving East Austin. But another thing is the fact that a lot of black families were not satisfied with the schooling in East Austin. And what that ended up doing is pushing them towards the suburban cities like Manor, Round Rock, Pflugerville, and Hutto, for example. So this dissatisfaction and feelings of being underinvested in really pushed black families out. And so during this whole time in the 30-year span, we're talking about a dwindling enrollment within a specific population that has not yet been addressed. And this is why some of those schools in East Austin are under-enrolled in the first place. So those are just some of the situations that we need to make sure AISD is aware of. And I think Dr. Stephanie Holly has been doing a good job in bringing that to light.
And we had talked a lot about sort of the systemic racism and how we got here as a city on a past episode that we did a while back with Dr. Kazike Prince, who works at the City of Austin. And we'll link that episode in the show notes, too, if you're just listening to this for the first time and thinking like, well, what's going on in Austin? It's Austin's such a progressive city. I don't understand, you know, why are our black populations dwindling like this? So we'll give you guys that episode, too, as context.
Progressive, yeah.
Yeah, in quotes, quote unquote, in air quotes. But this is, you know, you mentioned how some of the areas are being impacted just outside of Austin city limits. But so I'm curious about what else is happening across Texas, because not about all of our listeners live in Austin. So we always like to know, you know, what is the impact in other communities with similar issues? And have you all looked into that at all?
Yeah. Ricky talked a lot about Manor and Pflugerville, but we've actually been looking at some of the larger cities. So in Dallas, for example, Dallas ISD has gone through a huge revamp. They created an accelerated campus excellence program, ACE, and they implemented it in, I think, 7 schools. And after implementing that program, they're really targeting on retaining teachers, hiring highly effective principals, giving bonuses to teachers for working at low-performing schools. But in the year that they implemented that, they brought up 6 of their need improvement schools up to meeting standard. So they were, you know, they didn't have to close any schools. There were, you know, schools on the chopping block. But after implementing this program, they were really able to make a huge positive impact.
Yeah, and so if you look at Dallas ISD, it's interesting because their educational model, they found a way to make it work for their student body, which is predominantly black and Hispanic. If you look in San Antonio and Houston, however, they're still trying to find a way to get around the fact that majority of their student enrollment declines is being fed into the charter school system. So San Antonio is undergoing a huge charter school explosion. Houston ISD has contracted with the Rice University and the University of Houston to try to find ways in finding out why families are leaving ISD and taking their children to these charter schools. And that doesn't make it so unique to Austin, because Austin is kind of experiencing something similar. But what makes Austin unique is the fact that the demographic of the student body is predominantly white and Hispanic. And so it goes back to making sure that we accommodate these vulnerable populations here.
So you mentioned charter schools, and this is something, you know, as a good progressive, I always hear like, oh, I don't think I should like charter schools. I believe in public school systems. So, but I don't have a lot of experience in education. I think a lot of our listeners might be in the same boat. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what the explosion of charter schools, what that means for the public school system, what that means for our children and our communities just in general?
And what even is a charter school?
That's
for
a good
people
point.
who don't know?
Well, I mean, so you have traditional public schools in which are part of the traditional ISD, and then charter schools are initiatives to provide educational opportunities to the school that are not non-traditional in a sense. And so what that means is that when these students are going into these charter school spaces or whatnot, the insinuation is because the charter school is providing way, like, you know, they're providing open, better times for these students to go to and all these different types of things. But there's a reason why these students are going in the first place. It goes back to the feelings of inequity. And so we're talking about major cities in which they have a systemic racism that is accompanied with the traditional public school system. And so you start to see that people are looking for other opportunities. If it's not suburban cities that are surrounding these major cities that are providing these other opportunities, they might stay within the city and opt to send their kids to charter schools as a way to avoid some of the issues that they experience within these public school settings.
Yeah, and charter schools will kind of develop. So examples of charter schools are KIPP and IDEA, which we do have in Austin. And the idea is that there's a choice, right? Parents can choose to send their kids to their neighborhood school or their public school or go to a charter school, right? And there's a sense of competition, and this is across the country. There's a charter school explosion in San Antonio. In New Orleans, it's exclusively charter schools. They've done away with the public schools, which is really interesting. So in Austin, we do have a couple of charter schools. We actually just met with the charter school principal. He doesn't think that there's going to be an explosion in the same way, but there is kind of just that tension and that stress between, do I send my kid to a public school, right? Is that a good enough education for them? Or do I send them to a charter school where they are potentially, you know, they're branded as getting a better education and have these, you know, links to college? So that's kind of where the mm-hmm. tension ties
it's
in.
It's basically like
sense.
The privatization.
Oh, right.
Of education or school systems. Mm-hmm. And what I also heard from Arti was that, you know, the more students end up enrolling in charter schools, we end up losing a lot of funding for our public school system. So that can also be really problematic.
And there's actually, I mean, there are a couple of charter schools in Austin, though, that are under-enrolled, too. I mean, the land is really expensive for them to build on. Mm-hmm. It's not always fair to say that a charter school is going to give a better education or is fully enrolled or at capacity. It really depends. It really
yeah.
depends.
Yeah. You have to look into why people are believing that charter schools are going to provide better opportunities. Whether it may be true or not is something else, but there is a reason why people are losing faith within the public school education that Texas offers. Mm-hmm. And statewide, we know that the enrollment for charter schools are going up. Now, coincidentally, the enrollment for public schools are also going up, but within major cities, you're starting to see a declining enrollment. And as Annika was saying, that declining enrollment is due to a lot of competition with these charter school systems. And so that's something that you see a lot of school districts are struggling with across the state.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. It seems to me it's like putting a Band-Aid on an issue and not actually addressing the root cause of what's going on in the existing systems that we have.
I would say so, too. I mean, like, there's a lot of inequity that people are feeling. I mean, there's a sentiment there that needs to be tapped into before we just assume that people are going there because they're providing a better window as far as, oh, they're open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and, you know, AISD may not be doing the same thing. It's deeper than that. There's sentiments and feelings of inequity that the school system has historically underinvested in certain communities. And so once we tap into that, we'll find out what is the reason why families are opting to find better alternatives or what they perceive to be better alternatives than the ones that exist right here.
Yeah. Well, what can folks do? I mentioned earlier that we have the vote on these yes. AISD school closures. The next vote is going to be November 18th. So if people want to get more involved, what would you guys suggest they do, either here in Austin or even in their own yeah. communities when they see these issues happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say on an individual level, really making your voice heard. You know, talk to your trustee. They're working for you. They're representing your community. So it's okay to reach out, email them, call them, talk to them about issues that you see, and really stay informed on the issues. Things change quickly. You know, read the scenario document that AISD set out. And really stay as involved as possible. And I think we talked about this before, but those without children, it's important to remember that we're educating, right, future workers, future people in the labor force,
basically, like
that?
Everybody yeah. that you're ever going to
everybody
interact
that
with
you're ever gonna,
for the
right,
rest
right,
of your
like
life
these
in Texas
kids are super
are going
important.
Through our schools.
Right, yeah. exactly. And the school system is important to invest in, even if you don't have kids, because it really does play a role.
Yeah, that's a very important part, because if you're wondering whether you should care about children, you may not have children, or, you know, your children may have already been through the process of school or whatnot, you have to remember that these children are going to be, as Annika said, put into a labor force in which the retirees and the people who are going to be retiring are going to have to rely on a competent, educated workforce to help them accommodate their retirement into a good economy.
Our
right?
future mayor, our future governor, our future president could be going through the AIC right school now. System
exactly.
right now.
Exactly. And you know, when it sounds cliche, but like, you know, if that's what people need to hear to make them understand that, you know, when we're talking about children, we're talking about the future of this country. We were talking with our associate director earlier, and she was also stating that the demographics of this country is changing. And because the demographics of the country is changing, we need to be really committed to eliminating the disparities between non-white populations and populations of other demographic categories so that when they do get into these spaces or whatnot, we are talking about a better America for us all. Because it extends bigger than just Austin. This is, you know, this is a countrywide issue.
All right, that's it for Political Fuck, Marry, Kill for the week. Let us know what we missed on any of the socials at RouserTX.
This week's episode of The Rabble is brought to you by Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas, and they have an incredible event coming up on Saturday, November 9th that I am incredibly excited to attend. It is the Austin Annual Dinner, and they have a Cocktails for a Cause after party. Both events are going to be ridiculously fun. The keynote speaker is going to be Emmy-nominated actress, Emmy-winning producer, and trans rights activist Laverne Cox.
Ooh!
Right?
Oh my gosh. Life goals.
She's best known for her role in Orange is the New Black, so y'all should check her out, grab a seat. But the after party is potentially what I'm also most excited for. We're gonna have DJ Cassandra dancing and drinks. We'll have a wig bar by Coco Coquette.
Drag queens.
A drag show by an all-star cast of local queens. It'll be emceed by DJ Grandma Steven. So check it out. We'll link it in the show notes. You can head to weareplannedparenthood.org for more info as well, or follow PP Greater TX on social. Okay, Becky, what do you know this week?
Okay, so did you guys know that there are 11 Democrats running to take on John Cornyn for one of Texas's two Senate seats?
No. I knew there was a lot, but I didn't know it was 11. That's
11.
I don't know if I could even name them all.
No, but, well, that's kind of part of the problem is that there have been some polls of Texans, and most Texans don't know who any of them are. But they also, most Texans also don't know who John Cornyn is, so
that's good, I guess, then.
We actually have interviewed two of those Democratic candidates for U.S. Senate already. Christina Tsinsun Ramirez was the first woman that we interviewed, and then recently we interviewed MJ Hagar. And before season one comes to a close, we also wanted to interview Amanda Edwards, and we're so excited that she was able to join us in the studio here in Austin for that conversation. We are thrilled to welcome Amanda Edwards, candidate for U.S. Senate and current Houston City Council member. Amanda is an attorney with a degree from Harvard Law School, and she spent time as a community organizer before first running for city council and being out a crowded field for her city council seat in 2015. Thank you so much for being here, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm enjoying being in this wonderful, cozy studio you have here.
Yeah. Welcome. We are so happy you could come in. Amanda, you describe yourself as a servant leader. Can you define what that means to you?
Absolutely. I think a lot of the time, especially where we are today, there's a lot of emphasis on politics. Politics, 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 and not enough focus or emphasis on people. And when you think about servant leadership and thinking about it from the guise of where I come from in terms of my approach to it, it's really about working alongside people and achieving results together. And so really having a partnership, rolling up your sleeves, being present, but not just being present and delivering on the things that matter most to those in the community that are entrusting you with their support to actually serve them. It's an emphasis, it's a refocus on people rather than politics.
Well, I think that probably comes from your experience as a community organizer, I would imagine. So how do you see your experience in community organizing influencing your approach to serving in elected office?
Yeah, I've had a great number of interesting experiences that have kind of created this readiness for this job. Some of that related to my work in communities, working in community development corporations in Atlanta even, and looking at how there's this other fabric that that exists when you're dealing with how to really create long-term sustainable change, not just kind of gimmicky change, but real long-term sustainable change. And you've got to be present in the community. You've got to get the buy-in from the community. You've got to ask the community what it is that they need and want to see, and then what would they be willing to own? What part of this solution that they will be willing to be a part of? And so there's a true buy-in component to it. But then when you end up with a result, it's a result that everybody's happy about. There's not the resistance. It's a different approach, but it's not so much coming from the top down as it is coming from within the community to better serve the community. And so you have then stakeholders who are willing to take ownership of the issue, or it lives beyond just the term of the person in office or the person who's running a nonprofit, their tenure in that organization. It has to be something that is sustainable. And I think when we focus on people and getting the buy-in, the collaboration, those kinds of skills, you'll end up with a much better product than you ever would had you just assumed you knew all the answers and came in from the top down to give your answer to the issues that may exist when you really may not even appreciate them at all.
I love that approach, and I could see how you can do that successfully as a city leader on city council. So I'm curious, because you know you're closer to the community that you're serving, I'm curious how you would get that community buy-in as a senator when you seem, I mean, I feel like that office is a bit more removed.
Yeah, and I think that paradigm is what I seek to change. So I want to take this opportunity to turn that office on its head. Why is it the case, or why is it necessarily the case, that if you are occupying a Senate office, that the assumption is that you're removed from community? The truth of the matter is, yeah, you're not going to be present in the neighborhood every single day, and I'm not going to bump into you at the grocery store on a regular basis. But the truth is, you should have your finger on the pulse of the community that you are making and delivering policy for. And if you don't have a presence, if you're not listening, if you're not actively engaged, and there's all kinds of technology that make that possible today, but if you're not having that exchange, how can you best represent those folks that you're not even connected with? So I seek to make these seats, or in this seat in particular, much more accessible to people. Town halls, looking at ways in which we are finding out is what we are passing or working on working. I've had the great experience of being on the ground and seeing both some of the pros and the cons of federal policy on the ground in terms of how they impact neighborhoods and people, and having that vantage point from the very community that you're seeking to serve up to where there are gaps, loopholes, challenges, lack of funding, all of those pieces, and knowing where those funds come from, it actually provides me an enormous benefit and advantage in terms of being able to be more effective at the things that we set out to do as elected officials, particularly on the federal level. I serve on the National League of Cities Board of Directors, and in that role have had an opportunity to advocate about things like infrastructure funding and just a variety of things. Of course, I see the manifestation of the lack of funding on the ground, right, as we face our challenges with our infrastructure that's currently crumbling right before our eyes. We have an opportunity to use that type of localized experience and bring it up to the top and be accessible, be engaged, and better represent the people that elected us to serve.
I think that's great. And I'm curious to know, did you always know that you wanted to run for office, or what did that path look like
That's
for you?
That's always an interesting question. So, of course, I'm going to say something cliche. I don't like politics. I've always been interested in public service. I've always, in some way, so I was interning someplace, always been interested. But I really actually don't like politics. The things that you probably wouldn't like about politics is what I don't like about politics. People lie, people do this, you know, all the things that are negative. But the beauty of actually having direct impact, the beauty of being able to empower people, empower community, create a vision with the community, and realize the potential of a community, that is just, to me, so powerful and part of my purpose and my mission, that I'm willing to go through and navigate the politics in order to get to that type of end. And so when I think about it from a national policy standpoint, and I think about issues like, for example, access to health care. In my household, when I was growing up, my dad was diagnosed with cancer when I was about 10 years old. And I remember, even though my dad did pass away when I was 17, I remember those years and asking questions about the treatment my dad was getting and this insurance stuff because that's where I learned about this, right? And what if they say no? And what happens next? And knowing that for so many American families, that's a point of anxiety because it is a life and death issue. You need leaders that are going to be in Washington that understand the urgency of that issue. We don't have time to debate for 5, 6, 7 years about what should be the state of our healthcare system. We need to act now because there are lives that are hanging in the balance as we speak. People are depending on us to get to work and also deliver results. That's the other piece of this that's key to me is that does you no good to hear all these candidates, particularly around election time, give you wonderful, rousing speeches when at the end, they don't deliver for you. You've got to have the speech. You got to get energized. You got to go vote. And then you've got to get that result. Because otherwise what happens is democracy erodes away, right? So there, when we looked at the 18 cycle and how I got to here is I was planning to run for re-election for city council. I'm in city council in Houston. I served 2.3 million Texans already and was planning to run for re-election. And after seeing the results of the 18 cycle, had some conversations, and it was interesting what ended up really, you know, what we learned from that. When you saw Beto get all of these folks kind of in suburbs and independents and it just mobilized and out, it was great. Almost won this thing, you know, less than 215,000 votes. That's not a lot of votes in the state of Texas with 29 million people. But at the same time, what was important that we realized too is that there were some votes that were left on the table. People who had registered in high numbers but didn't come back out in high numbers. So people under the age of 35, people who were also communities of color. And what I know needs to take place now is that we've got to have a candidate that can get those folks in the middle excited again, but who can also galvanize those portions of the base that didn't turn back out and actually vote despite having been registered. And some of the time when that happens, a lot of the time when it happens, it's because people aren't seeing the nexus to their lives. So they know you want to vote, but they wanted to vote last time and nothing changed. They're not seeing that result in their lives. And what that does is erode democracy. So when you put people in office, you got to put people in office who are most prepared, most inclined, most ready to actually be effective. And so for me, I don't say things or make promises I don't keep. I have to talk about the things that I'm going to do because I know that part of what this is about is broader than that just one conversation. It's about having faith in your government, being able to actually make that democracy work. One of my favorite things that President Obama said before he left office was when he said that the power lies in the hands of the average ordinary American citizen. And if we actually internalize that and people reclaim that power, think about all that we really could accomplish if we said, you're not doing the things you said. You got to go, you know, you'd be nice about it. You don't have to be nasty. But the key is you got to get people in who are going to get the job done because people's lives are depending on this economic opportunity. Think about issues of gun violence. Think about issues pertaining to prescription drug costs, health care. I mean, there's a litany of things, immigration reform, so many things we can be talking about, you know, climate change. I mean, a variety of things. But we've got to do the things that need to be done to actually address and resolve them. And that's the key piece, I think, that I bring to the table is an emphasis on doing, mobilizing all of these communities that may be disconnected, but need to have a restored confidence that the work will get done.
Yeah, I think that's really a great perspective. And I like your focus on results because I do think it's true that a lot of times people don't see the connection to their actual lives from their elected officials. So I'm curious to know from you in your time on city council, what is the result that you helped produce that you're most proud of?
Oh, I have many of them. One I will say was something I wasn't necessarily expecting to do was I started a task force for tech and innovation in the city. And that's not my background. I'm a lawyer by trade. And I just remembered learning kind of where things were with Houston and tech and learning VC was not readily available. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, why is that? You know, we've got a strong economy. Otherwise, what's the issue here? And it just, you know, kind of intrigued me. So when it was clear that we didn't have a clear answer on that, then I put together a task force We explored it. We came home with recommendations, and it's been so fun to watch it grow. And we've got a new nonprofit that's formed that's kind of houses the implementation of these strategies. We have a new fund-to-funds model. We have a new innovation district that we just broke ground on. And so to see leadership on a local level or just in government, a lot of times people assume that that means dysfunction. You can partner with the private sector. Many of what I'm describing, these are partnerships with the private sector or led. I mean, these are just ways in which you get it sparked and get things moving and have a vision and execute on it. And I think that's what it needs to be about, is executing on vision, whether that's in a vision of something grand or something very small. It's about following through with what you say you're going to do and getting that improvement to take place.
And I like that, you know, seeing a need and asking questions about why that need exists and then going about filling it. I think that's great.
Yeah, you don't have to be the substantive issue expert on the topic in order to get involved on a topic. It's kind of an ability. It's kind of your job to see holes and fill them, or to see opportunity and pursue them. And, you know, you've got to, as I like to call it, walk and chew gum, because you're going to have a gazillion crises that come your way, and you've always got to respond to those, and you should. But where's the vision? And so you won't have the growth without the vision, and it doesn't always have to come from in government. It can come from outside, but how do you become the best partner of some effort that will really propel the community or state forward or the nation forward? When I think about access to education, higher ed, you know, I'll be very candid with you. Why are the costs of higher ed education costs and tuition costs going up so high? Are people getting better education or better access to jobs, or are we just not keeping that under control? Mm-hmm. And so we've got to be, it needs to go beyond just loan forgiveness. We need to really think through, why is the rates of tuition increasing like this in the first place? All the private and the public institutions get access to grant dollars from the feds. There can be controls. We haven't done that yet, but I think we need to have good policy in place, public policy in place, when we think about some of the treasures of our community and making sure that we are creating a paradigm where people have access, more access to opportunity rather than less.
Yeah, and I want to go back to something that you touched on earlier, healthcare.
Yes.
And, I think in this primary season, it can a lot of times be difficult for Democrats to differentiate from each other in a primary race. And in the presidential primary, one way that candidates are doing that is by talking about their stance on Medicare for All.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, where do you fall on the Medicare for All debate?
On the Medicare for All spectrum. So again, I'll go back to my original personal experience with it, in that my perception is that the issue is urgent in terms of lives lying in the balance. And so when I think about Medicare for All, and for those that are listening, because I know we toss these terms around all the time, but it's basically essentially an expansion of the Medicare system so that everybody falls under that umbrella. It's one single payer is what that means. And so in that context, I believe we can have consensus around fixing the Affordable Care Act and still achieve the goal of making sure that we're expanding the number of insured. We have a public option that is affordable, but then at the same time driving down those premium costs. If I take the model that I've described to you, which is listening to what people say, part of the things that you've heard people talk about in that context was wanting a public option. That's one piece. But then you also heard people talk about wanting options, meaning some people wanted to keep employer-based insurance. I think we have to listen to what people are saying, because otherwise you're going to be back at the drawing board because you didn't listen to them in the first place. So that's one piece. The other thing that you hear people complaining about is premiums going up. People are mad, very mad, that the premiums are going up, and they should be, right? Because the cost of healthcare in our country is just too high. So what do we do about that? Drive them down. How do you do that? Well, looking at things like the transparency needed in billing. And right now they're odd ways, I won't get into the specifics, of how billing takes place in these categories and things like that. And you have a lot of opportunity to drive some of those premium costs down. The other piece of this that doesn't get discussed very often was, you know, part of the changes under the Affordable Care Act was that the insurance pools weren't as predictable as one would think. And so that drives premiums up. So there were some challenges there that we can work on fixing, like driving those premiums back down, getting an affordable price point on a public option, And that way, if you are a proponent of Medicare for All, you can still say, I want a public option. But if you're somebody who said, I want to keep my private insurance, you can keep your private insurance. And there are options there that exist and fit the needs of different people in different circumstances. The other piece I will say to this also is that we've got to close some of the gaps and the loopholes, right? So we've grown those under the Trump administration. There's something called short-term insurance that has expanded, which doesn't give you access to being adequately insured. You have less insurance than you thought you might be paying for. Or you were paying your premiums, and then when it's time for you to get a service and you say, oh, I'm not covered. We don't need those kinds of surprises for people. People need to get adequately insured if they're paying into a program. And so those are some of the elements that I think we can fix now, because, again, when I think about it, I go back to my childhood. And I know what that anxiety feels like. And so I can't imagine debating Medicare for All for the next 5, 6, 7 years as people, they lose their lives. And may not be covered, and we don't have a system that has embraced more people. And another thing that's not a federal issue that needs to be fixed, however, happens to be the whole Medicaid expansion issue. And that's caused a lot of pressure, a lot of problems as it relates to rural hospital closures and just a variety of things like that. And we have got to get it together. I mean, we are number one for uninsured Americans in the country, in the state of Texas. We have almost 1 million I was getting ready to call them babies. They're not babies, they're children, but they're little ones who are not covered under CHIP. I mean, we've got to do better than that. We cannot be ranked high among the problems that are one of the most secure, you know, biggest issues of security that we can have is our health care. So those are the ways I kind of think about it. I connect it back to people, results, and how do we achieve the goals in a way that, you know, actually can get that done and do it in a time that respects the urgency of the issue.
Yeah, I totally agree. And on that Medicaid expansion issue and the healthcare challenges that we face here in Texas, I just have to give a little plug because we are helping with a campaign called Sick of It Texas.
Yeah.
And we're doing block walks for healthcare this
awesome.
Coming weekend, November 9th and 10th. So if y'all are listening, make sure you check to see if there's a block walk near you and join it, because what we're doing is going door to door and asking people about what their experience with health insurance and their healthcare challenges so that we can take that information back to our leaders and make sure that they are prioritizing healthcare the way that voters are prioritizing it.
And if there isn't a block walk, maybe you can start one.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of things about, you know, your childhood and your growing up years. But I am curious to know if you can tell us sort of a very on-brand story or incident from your growing up years. Like, for example, I used to make cassette tapes of myself pretending to do a radio show about books I was reading in elementary school, and now I host a podcast that's basically a book report on Texas politics.
I used to do that, too.
Did you? Oh, my God.
My girlfriend and I, we used to do, like, pretend radio shows.
That's we also made music videos with, like, with dolls or with our dogs, and I've yet to have that pan out in my life.
That's our next phase. So, sorry, Amanda, you
it's
go.
It's okay. I will use the example. I don't talk about this much, but I remember when I ran for class president of my high school. And at that time, so I had gone to a really small parochial school up until eighth grade. And so I didn't know when I went to the big public high school, it was 1 out of 1,000 freshmen. So it was a huge change from like 60 kids to 1,000 kids. And so I was involved in some of our class committees, but, you know, I wasn't an officer of the class. And so I remember there was a person in leadership at that time who suggested that I ought to consider running for vice president, and he would be the president of the class, and I could help him in his role as president, as if I could not do it myself as a young lady, I guess. And in that case, and I'm being nice, but but in that case, it infuriated me, of course, and it's like, what? You know, I stand next to you and tell you all the stuff. You know, give me
right.
a break. I don't need to do that. And so I remember going home that day, and I went home and I told my parents. And I wasn't one to, like, overshare with my parents. You know, I was kind of my own little mini adult in my mind, you know. And I told them what had happened, and I was just – livid. And so my mom tells me this story later, but my dad just kind of laughed and chuckled and said he has no idea what he's done. And so the next day, I was ready. It was almost like eFlick Central here, you know, like I was ready to be class president. I had signage. I was ready to go. And of course, I hadn't run for an office before at that point. And so did not let that deter me in any way. And we just worked so hard and ended up winning that election.
Yay.
So
you showed him.
Yes. The first of many.
That's right. So that was my first time, like, really being like, I don't think so, you know, and we can do this a different way. And it doesn't have to just be the status quo.
I love that. That's a great story. That reminds me, I ran for vice president in high school, student body. And during the debates, one of the reasons I was told that I lost was because I used too big of words.
Oh, no. Oh, wow. Oh, we don't like that. We don't like that.
But, yeah, I think that's just another, like, you know, misogyny kind of thing rearing its head.
Yeah.
I love that story. And I
have not told that story in a long time, so I was like, how do I say this nicely?
That's great. Well, I know that you've got a lot going on here while you're in town, so we don't want to keep you too long. But I do have one last hard-hitting question for you.
Yeah.
What is your most listened to campaign road trip album?
I don't know. You know what? I'm going to be honest with y'all, seriously. So I'm going to tell y'all, I'm going to, you know, demystify campaigning. It's not a lot of, like, well, at least on my campaign, I've got to be on the phone asking people for money. I mean, I'm making political calls. I'm not in the car listening to radio stations and flipping through albums. I'm on the phone entire time.
Yes.
Yeah. So my album is calling people on the phone and either talking about meeting with them. And so the real life of campaigns are, you know, you've got to multitask. So when you're on the road, you know, well, and sometimes, sadly, we eat a lot of fast food. I shouldn't say all that, but you do. You have to do what you can do when you're on the road. But there isn't music playing in the car.
It's probably music to your ears when someone's like, I support you. Yes, I'm going to donate to your campaign.
I love it when they say, what else can I do to help? I was like, yes, there's so many things.
Well, people listening right now might be wondering what they can do to help you and where can they find your campaign and how to support you.
Sure. So we've got a website, www.amandafortexas.com. Going onto the website and signing up to volunteer, signing up also to get our emails. We have a store where we have nice little handy buttons and shirts and even workout clothes. So we've got we've got the whole shebang. But then also you can, of course, donate. So we're driving and going across the state. It is a big state. So it's an expensive race. So whatever you can, make your sacrifice, whether you're not taking in your Starbucks or whatever on Fridays anymore, or whatever your indulgence is, think about sacrificing that so we can have strong, sound leadership in our country. And so make sure to donate. Also follow us on social media, on Instagram as Amanda for Texas, the number 4, but then also on Facebook and Twitter, Amanda for Texas, F-O-R, and share our launch video. I think it really depicts what this campaign is about for us, which is that it's about people and the issues that matter most to them, and that it's our time really to reclaim our power so that we can get people the results that they deserve in their lives. And I think that that video is very inclusive, and it just captures a lot of the energy that this movement is about. So please follow us, share our materials, and of course support us on the campaign by donating and volunteering your time.
Amanda Edwards, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for all of your work to make Texas a better place.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was fun.
Thank you. Okay, Ashley, I'm ready for my shit to do. What is it?
Okay, well, we are about a year away from the November 2020 election.
Yeah,
I'm
like literally
so excited.
We just had an election.
I've been waiting for this election for 4 years, since the 2016 election. It's like all we think about here, and it's just a year away. And yeah, we just did have an election, and you know, the turnout was pretty so-so for that election. I think it was like 10% of total registered voters turned out.
Which is like, you know, it's an off election. We had about half of registered Texas voters turn out in 2018, which is also funny when I look at those numbers because everyone was so excited about the turnout in 2018 and it was only half of registered voters, not even total Texans who are, you know, eligible to vote. So I feel like we should just quickly even talk about the election that just happened.
Okay, real quick.
Real quick. Speed info. Lightning round. So there were those 10 constitutional amendments, and all of them passed except for one, which was the one that was about, like, judicial, you know, how many seats, judicial seats you could hold, which is a shame because we supported that one. And I think it'll just make it harder for people in rural areas potentially to seek good representation and have good people because it sounds like there just aren't enough. And they needed to hold multiple offices. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one was number four.
Yeah, that one, we didn't want it to pass, and it did pass. But Travis County voted against it. And this one, I feel like, was very tricky because it was stating that it would ban a state income tax and putting that in the Constitution. But there already was a state income tax ban in the Constitution. And what this did was, I think a possible unintended consequence is allowing corporations to argue that they're individuals and therefore don't need to pay a state income tax because of the way that the wording was changed versus what was previously in the state income
tax. That's like Citizens
ban.
United, right? Yeah. Where it's just like people are trying to make corporations have the same rights as people, like freedom of speech is getting money and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. So it's very possible now that corporations will successfully sue to argue that they're individuals and not subject to state income tax, which would mean like $9 billion of revenue that the state of Texas would lose for education and other services. So that is a little scary thing to keep our eyes on the horizon about.
Yeah. And then if you listen to our last podcast with Mayor Steve Adler here in Austin, we were talking about why we wanted the two Prop A and Prop B, two props here we had in the city, voted down. Quick update. They did get voted down.
Yay!
So yay.
Good job, guys.
That was fantastic. For those of y'all who listened and went out and voted, thank you so much. And there's a lot of you guys who tagged us in your Instagram stories and your posts and your Facebook. So thank you for that. We love seeing everyone out there voting.
Yeah.
It really warmed our hearts.
It did. It makes my day when people actually use the information that we provide and find it useful. So, oh, thank you.
Thank you. But back to the shit to do. So good work for those of you all who voted. But we have a really big election coming up. And there are some amazing people out there on the ground mobilizing and organizing right now. And one of them, who we've talked about on the podcast before, is She the People.
Love them.
Amazing. And I had the benefit of hearing a friend of ours, a friend of the pod, Alice or Mingfei Yi, speak at an event for the Asian Family Support Services of Austin this past weekend. And I realized while listening to her speak, and oh, she was amazing, that I was so emotionally touched by her words, not only because she shared some really personal stories, but also because I realized that I didn't have a ton of Asian role models out there growing up, you know, of like good examples of female leadership who are out there speaking in public platforms like this. And I kind of had this like little girl moment of like, oh my God, here's a role model for me to look up to.
Like, I could do that.
I could do that one day. And I think we need more people like that, more diverse leaders out there so that, you know, folks can have someone to look up to and, you know, have faith in our systems. And the work that She the People is doing is encouraging just that.
Yay!
So they are organizing a member-wide call on November 20th, and you can sign up online. They have a new video that they also just put out that's super inspiring, so I'm going to link that in the show notes, and y'all can watch it and share it. And they're trying to get everyone in their network to invite five people to join this new political home they've created at shethepeople.org. And they're working on building this movement also because, you know, there's an article that NBC News just put out about how women of color, you know, are women of color the key to beating Trump? And I feel like the answer is yes. I mean, we know that black women are the Democrats' single most loyal voting bloc. They have 94% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. But that turnout was down since previous years. And so it's something that we, you know, women of color oftentimes don't feel like they're being reached out to properly. And, you know, the Democratic Party really can't take them for granted.
Yeah.
And She the People is there to make sure we don't.
And they're not just reliable voters. They are a huge part of the force on the ground doing the work, getting people elected, like doing the hard work of knocking on doors and making phone calls.
And building those coalitions.
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. So join the team. We'll link it in the show notes or go to shethepeople.org and RSVP to join that member-wide call on November 20th. That's your shit to do. Or at the very least, watch their video and share it.
Love it. So good.
All right. That's it for our show this week, guys. Follow us on social at RouserTX. Join us for our live show November 19th. We would love to see you here in Austin at the Riveter. And
get your ticket right now before prices go up, too.
Yes.
Yeah. We can't wait to see you there and party.
Yeah. See y'all. And tell your friends about us and our live show and all the things.
And we'll see y'all there.
Bye.